This time on the show, Story is back.
Flashbacks, flash forwards, and flash sideways.
And what's the difference between a story and a backstory? All this and more on Comics Are Great. It's Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show recorded live out of the Ann Arbor District Library Netcast Studio in downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan, right on the corner of 5th and William. And this is the show about comics, comics lifestyle, how to make comics, how to write comics, how to think about comics, so all the different stuff that surrounds this medium that we love so much. And, oh, is this for comics creators then? Well, no, because we talk about a whole lot of things that I think would be of interest to anybody who just enjoys comics or is curious about comics, like, you know, if you are curious about wine and you want to know what's the difference between a Merlot and a Cabernet, this is a show where we talk about...
Please call in. Let us know.
But we've got a big... big round table today.
This is amazing.
This is going to be a fun show because, okay, I'm going to go through the introductions real quick. We've got Paul Story, who has returned.
Hey, I'm back.
Paul Story, the smaller Paul Story.
The reduced, as they used to say.
The reduced Paul Story of Storyville.com has returned to be our in-studio guest. Good to see you again, Paul.
Good to see you again, Jersey.
And then,
I actually mean that.
Oh, wow. That's nice to hear. So then we've got, speaking of good to see, one of the best-looking guys in comics, Brandon Dayton, is on the Skypes, Brandon Dayton of BrandonDayton.com.
Hey, good to be here.
And then last-minute addition, man, I got to extend my heartfelt gratitude to Dave Roman of YayTime.com, who showed up at the last minute, just woke up. He's eating his steel-cut oats as he quickly wraps up his breakfast to talk about comics with us. So, you know, I never take time to express my gratitude also to the Ann Arbor District Library for putting on this show. You know, it's been a little over a year since we started recording out of the AADL Netcast studio. And Matt Dubé, Matt, are you there? Are you on the mic?
I think so.
Okay, I hope you make it into the recording. Matt Dubé works so hard to put the show together.
He really does. And
when I first approached the library about doing the show, I said, hey, it should be live. It should be live streamed. And we should even be able to have people call in on Skype. And they didn't have any of that stuff set up yet. Matt set all this stuff up. And before anybody goes like, oh, well, Jersey, what kind of poll do you have? It wasn't just for me, because you guys do a lot of different shows out of the Ann Arbor District Library Netcast Studio, don't you, Matt?
Well, we're working on a couple. We've got three in the works. One's a maker podcast called Tinker Hub. The other one is a show about scents that we're working on. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Glass Petal Smoke, but it's a popular blog that delves into scents. And then we're working on that show.
Scents as in smell.
Aromas.
Thank you.
And it's a podcast about smells?
It's an interesting concept. It's going to be fun to see how that comes together. And then we've got one more. It's called Talking to My Generation. It's some great kids from the Gen X and Gen Y generation talking to other generations about, I don't know, different topics and how the generations differ on their views.
And how the Who was before their time.
Well, some of the people on the show will probably not know about the Who, but others may.
But so the point is that you guys are producing more shows than just this now, and then you can find them at aadl.org. But you know what's interesting, and this is the thing I want to throw at the top, you know, is that these guys are quickly becoming what I think is the 21st century model for PBS. And as we all know, when President Romney is in charge in a few months, and it will happen, everybody. Not that, you know, I'm not making
wow,
any political.
You are a ray of sunshine.
But when he's in charge and he gets rid of PBS, thank goodness we've got AADL.org to put on more shows. Now, yes. Anybody don't read into that statement.
Once Big Bird's been killed, Matt will be taking his place.
Yeah, but no. And actually, I want to make it clear that I don't have any particular political leanings. And one of the fun things that I like to do with people is say, well, what do you think I am as far as like left
just
or right?
Pick or pick whatever they don't like and grind them up.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
But the funny thing that I get is like from my left-wing friends, they're like, well, you seem like a well-adjusted guy, so you've got to be a Democrat. And then my right-wing friends say, well, you seem like a well-adjusted guy, so you've got to be a Republican. And I don't like to answer that question either way. I was just making a little
I'm
joke.
I'm more but. Like, you're not very well-adjusted at all. Actually, my question is, how is Anne making you vote?
No, we thought about canceling each other's votes out a la Archie Bunker. But no, that's another discussion for another time. Because this week we've got to talk about backstory. Then we're going to dive right into the topic. Then we'll talk a little bit more about what you guys actually do to establish your credibility. First, let's let your words speak louder than your actions as we dive into this. Brandon, you pitched this topic. So let's hear from you. Why backstory? Why is this topic interesting to you?
Well, most topics that become interesting to me are because I'm, trying to understand them. So, I come into this discussion with a lot of ill-formed thoughts, as usual, and trying to kind of make sense of them. I was just doing some writing, and I kind of was finding this conflict that I was having between, I guess, using backstory as kind of as a climactic tool versus using backstory as getting information that you need to move the story along. So it started making me wonder a lot about, backstory and how to use it and its purposes and whatnot.
So both from a theoretical standpoint and then a practical standpoint of like how to actually put it into use, maybe it'd be a good idea to throw out the mischaracterizations of backstory first and then see if we can... go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting, though, because there are basically two distinct uses for the term backstory, in that there are some people, and Brandon seems to be focused on this side, this side of the coin, how's that, which is the backstory that plays into the story, that actually comes out, the story, backstory is what happens before your story starts, and some people use it to refer to what they bring in flashbacks and exposition, in dialogue, talking about what happened previously. But I also think of backstory as just the history of the characters, of the setting, of the thing that doesn't, and not all of that's necessarily going to make it onto the page. So we're actually dealing with two aspects. We have to decide how much of that backstory actually makes it into the story.
Yeah, and I think when we were discussing it earlier, the way we were kind of talking about it is there's backstory as it relates to the story, and then kind of as Paul's saying, world building aspect of backstory where you kind of flesh out the world so you understand the world, but that may not be necessary to your story that you're telling. It may not actually help the story, but it helps you understand the world, I guess.
Yeah, that's how I was trying to wrestle with this one, too, is I was cobbling together some rough notes for this, and I was trying to figure out, there's the old idea, the old notion of you have to build a complete and solid world. I brought an example. Here's a 10-year-old notebook. I've got this is volume one of pages and pages.
Do you want me to just...
I can just do it this way. That's fine. I don't want... It's not necessarily that anybody reads it, but, doing, study designs of spaceship. This was for, my big space opera thing that it was going to... 8 volumes, 1,000 pages. Oh, maps, everybody! Look at this! And I've got all the different cultures mapped out. I had alphabets designed, and I had languages and different races. And there's several notebooks just filled with notes about the backstory of this world, and... I thought, well, that's what you got to do. You have to did you want to look at it, Paul?
No,
you kept eyeballing it.
No, it just looked like you were going to, end up reaching back and then just,
dropping it. No, but yeah, I thought you had to do that. And I realized that I was writing so much stuff that I wasn't actually writing anything about the characters in the story. I was writing about the world that they were going to live in. And I broke it down. I'll pitch this to you guys and see what you guys say about this. I thought I was trying to figure out, okay, what's the function of this thing? What purpose does backstory serve based on, or leaping off of what you just said about whether it's to support the narrative or whether it's the world in which the characters live? And I thought, well, there's historical backstory, world-buildy stuff, and this is the Lord of the Rings movie's front end, right? They spend 3 minutes going, this is the world, this is the ring, the seven rings for the elves and whatever, or dwarves. And then there's motivational, character-y backstory, and this is like the intro scene to The Incredibles, where they're setting up that this was once the world that these characters lived in, and then it changed, and now we're getting to the story, where it's about the guy trying to get his old life back. Batman, here's his parents, they're dead, now he's Batman, the end.
Which is interesting, because, of course, that was add-on backstory. That was never the original. There was no backstory.
The 1938 Batman?
Yeah. It started out, and somewhere, a few issues in, they went, we should probably explain something.
Huh.
So they made,
They came up with that powerful, powerful story that to this day people still talk about. And then there's revelatory or plotty backstory, and this is Harry Potter, where, wait, Harry, don't do the thing until I tell you about this historical thing that I didn't tell you about in Chapter 2, but now it's Chapter 8, so it's time for me to tell you. Or V for Vendetta, where we slowly find out more and more about the history of V to understand more of what the ramifications and stakes are of the plot. Did I miss anything, or is this a mischaracterization of the three different types of backstory? Dave?
No, that was good.
That's a good breakdown. Yeah.
Now Dave's setting you on. Dave's setting you up with a false sense of security.
I know.
Before he pounces later.
Shut it down.
Okay. But I mean, like, I think the looking for a useful way to talk about this thing beyond, like, you know, diagrammatic professorial kind of classroom stuff. How do we know when we've crossed the line between being the dungeon master who's constructed all these maps and worlds?
I would argue actually I find it funny that you do that. You specify like the dungeon master who's like laying out too much stuff, whereas most dungeon mastering is actually done to echo the sandbox world building that Tolkien did. So in other words, you're kind of like saying, oh, when are we, you know, are we taking too much from RPGs? But I think RPGs took it straight out of the idea that Tolkien, you know, started out with his languages and his histories.
Sure, sure.
The interesting part is how much do you need to know to tell, or, you know, the important thing is how much do you need to know to tell the story you want to tell? And if you don't, you know, if you don't need to know what King Kamehameha, you know, ate for lunch, you know, in the 13th century, then don't do it.
But you're speaking as somebody who's had his share of writing projects. You know that. You have a gut feeling about it through doing it over and over and over again, right? But I'm saying to the young person who comes to me with, like, I've got this 8-volume epic like I did in that notebook, right? And, like, how do they know? What are the warning signs to look out for to know that you're spending too much time working on worlds and not enough time working on... What I'm trying to get at is, what's the difference between story and backstory? Can we define that?
Yeah, you know, I was trying to think about this over the last couple of days, and one question I was trying to figure out is, what's the difference between backstory and just non-linearity? You know, there's a lot of stories that may jump around in a different linear sequence, like Memento, or, you know, that's just, you know, one I can think of. And some of those, it's the whole story is just chock full of flashbacks and flash forwards and flashes to the side and stuff. And, you know, I really wonder if structurally that's any different. You know, maybe backstory, when we think of backstory, we kind of feel like it's in smaller amounts. But I wonder if it's really doing anything different than a larger, more complex, non-linear story. I don't know. Maybe that doesn't answer that question at all.
Well, I want to throw in another dynamic of this. Like, we're talking mostly about from the writer's perspective, but there's also to sort of take in the audience perspective. Paul was mentioning Batman and how originally there wasn't necessarily an origin story to that character, but eventually people felt they needed to add one, right? Whereas now you can't make a Batman movie without going right to the origin story. Every time they do a superhero movie, everybody wants to tell the origin story. Nobody really trusts audience to just do a superhero movie that just sort of takes the character, you know, in the middle of a story. Everybody wants to be the one to tell that origin story. And I'm not sure if that's because the audience demands that or, you know.
There's a certain lack of trust, I think, I think that they don't trust the audience to know something that may be, even though it's a part of the popular consciousness, I don't think they necessarily trust the audience to
know. Yeah, I can see that. Because there's always going to be someone in the audience that doesn't know Spider-Man's origin story, or, you know. When I first went and saw the Spider-Man movies, I really didn't know all his history with Uncle Ben. That was, like, totally new to me, and I had read Spider-Man since, like, forever, you know, so...
Well, I just think it's, like, interesting with the new Spider-Man movie, which is only a couple of years since the previous. Some people enjoy seeing the retelling, like, oh, you know, oh yes, here's the classic Uncle Ben story again. Yeah. And other people were like, ah, just get past the Uncle Ben stuff and get right to the meat, you know.
Why are we watching this again?
Yeah.
I wonder though if I kind of feel like in structurally though, the origin story is kind of, I mean, it's kind of the why should I care part of the story. And I don't know, you had your three categories before Jersey, right?
Oh, historical, motivational, and revelatory.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the backstory is kind of historical and motivational in some ways. And I think maybe one of the questions for writers to ask is to be very clear about what type of story they're telling and then kind of understanding what type of backstory they're using. One story that a friend of mine kind of told me about that I thought was really interesting was about the development of Finding Nemo. When they were making Finding Nemo, they were having real problems with the story working. And originally, it was the whole story had these flashbacks to Nemo's past, or what's I can't remember Nemo's father's name, but kind of, you know, that whole story where the mother dies and everything. There used to be a series of flashbacks throughout the movie. And finally they decided, you know what, for us to care about what he's doing throughout this whole movie, we just need to know this right now. So they ended up just putting that all in the beginning. And I think at one point they wanted it to be revelatory and they realized, no, this isn't revelatory. This is like motivational. We need to know this to even get the story started. You know,
is that to be sympathetic to that character? Because like taking that aspect out of it, maybe he becomes annoying, right? Because he's so paranoid and he's so, you know, he's a sort of high maintenance father. So you could just be like, oh, this guy, this father, you know, what's this guy's deal? But I guess if you know that he's a survivor of, you know, this death of his wife and those other kids, it makes you sort of put up with him more.
Well, as Rob Worley described it, it's a home invasion, right? It starts out with a home invasion and a murder.
Yeah,
well,
yeah, there's something going on around online about like, oh, like a fake text exchange about, oh, I just watched this thing about this guy whose wife was murdered and his son is kidnapped and he has to go and find him. It's like, what is that? It's called Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
Which is ironic too, because then in what is it, John Carter, it's like he didn't learn the lesson, because John Carter is basically flashbacks of why you should care about John Carter throughout the movie, when it's like, I don't know, you know, he it's the same story. It's his family getting murdered, but you get that in flashbacks throughout the movie instead of right at the beginning. So I thought that was kind of ironic. And I didn't care. In the case of John Carter, I was like, I don't see why this is even in here. So.
Well, and mostly it was added. That was that was not the Princess of Mars story.
Oh, so, really? Yeah. I still haven't seen it. I heard both good things and terrible things about it.
I loved certain aspects of it, but a lot of the story stuff, you're just like, you know, get on with it. And that's a good, that's kind of a good indicator. You know, you were saying about, well, you're talking about what's too much prep, but I think there's also a point where it's like, what is too much exposition and, you know, expository backstory.
Like the beginning of the Lord of the Rings films, right? Which, I
would argue that was necessary.
Yeah.
But in John Carter, what they ended up doing was telling you way too much about what happens before. You know, there's the old adage, I think it actually came from screenplays, but the old adage, come in late, get out early. Try and just pare things down to what the audience absolutely needs, instead of kind of, he got up in the morning, he took a shower, he ate his steel-cut oats in front of a live studio audience.
Well, John Carter does something in addition to that, too, though, because the movie actually opens with like a flash forward to what you're going to see later in the film, right? Like, it doesn't just start with John Carter and his normal life and how he ends up on Mars. They open the film with like a Mars battle sequence, like a big action sequence, as if to say, like, sit through the next 20 minutes where he's like in the Civil War and he's a prisoner and he's going to go through, because eventually we're going to see spaceships. And,
oh God, I am so guilty of that.
Wait for it.
Wait for it.
Wait for it.
Another animated film that I think of that does a lot of jumping around like that, at least initially, is The Emperor's New Groove. Have you guys seen that?
No.
Yeah, I like that movie.
I love
it.
It's
been a while, but yeah.
I thought it was really good. But it starts with a llama crying in the rain, and then you have David Spade's voice coming in saying, like, yeah, you see that llama? That used to be a king, and this is his story. And then he backs up to before he became a llama to get to the point halfway through the film where he's the llama in the rain again, right?
Yeah. Although, but, you know, and again, there's where I start getting that weird twitchy feeling. It's like, how much, once you've incorporated it into your story, I feel weird calling it backstory.
Well, okay, that's where I was trying to get at here. So I think we're roundabout coming to the answer to that question, is that Dave and Paul, you both said that you made an emphasis on caring. Well, and Brandon, you talk about Finding Nemo. You made an emphasis on getting the audience to care about the character, give a damn about what's going to happen to this character. I know. So if it's information that contributes to you caring about the character, then it's not really backstory. It's part of the story, right? I mean,
right.
The Captain America movie.
Story.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, that's the TV series Lost is like 100% all about that, because it's constantly jumping back and forth between a present day scenario where the characters are doing things that are very despicable and you're like, what the hell is the deal with these characters? So they're constantly flashing back to sort of get you to be a little bit sympathetic, to sort of see that there's supposedly this underlying reason why these characters are acting so cryptically or so strangely, or ways that you're like, why would you do that? And then they flash back and show you
like,
sort of,
okay,
you know, their past that, you know, and it's constantly doing that. And then like, Brandon said, like, eventually they flash forward and then they flash sideways and then they do all the flashes.
I think one of the reasons that works with Lost too is because there is such a large cast of characters. You know, there's from the beginning, there's always someone that you care about. So they start with a compelling story and you have a lot of other side characters like Locke. Locke gets introduced while they're telling some other character's story. And initially he's a very, you know, two-dimensional character. He's just this kind of really mysterious guy, you're not sure if he's good or evil, and then you can tell his backstory later when it's time. But you know, if it was just a story about Locke, you'd be like, I don't care, why do I care about this guy, you know? But because they have all these other stories you care about, then you're patient enough when you get to his story, you know. So I thought that was interesting.
But I want to drive at this in one more direction, because we just got to motivational as far as like the function of backstory. But I want to get to world building stuff, because there are such things as stories where it's about living in a world, right? When you talk about Tolkien again, I mean, he's a great example, one of the primary examples of a book that is just as much about looking at the frickin' bushes of Middle Earth as it is about following Frodo and Sam's struggles.
Well,
right?
Maybe not quite. Quite equal.
Second book with Legolas, Gimli, and Aragorn running. There's like a whole chapter of describing the landscape as they're running.
I do realize that, but yeah. I would argue might not be quite equal importance.
Okay, but yeah. So I mean, there's a case for this world building stuff. Yeah. And what are some good examples that people could look at of books where they do that kind of world building?
You know what? I don't know why it popped to mind as I was driving out here. Howard Chaykin's American Flag.
Really?
Because it's you know, it's a very different, it's started as our world, but lots of spin. It's a science fiction setting, and he didn't always like go, okay, this is what happened here, and this is what happened here. And like, you know, for the character, he's like, oh, Reuben Flagg used to be a TV star, got replaced by digital technology, which, wow.
You prescient.
Know, yeah. And, you know, hey, you know, things were going south and suddenly, like, consumerism took over everything. But he doled it out. You know, like, he would introduce the concept of the Metroplex and then kind of dole out as throughout the story, like, what exactly that meant. You know, what it meant for the city to be a mall, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I looking back on that, he did a really amazing job of coming up with a world that, you know, with familiar aspects, but that had been changed dramatically, you know, through a series of events, and then kind of doling out those events, and also the various character histories, where, you know, somebody would show up, and it's like, oh no, it's so and so, and then you find out, you know, that these people have, you know, a history together. So it was one that just kind of jumped out at me. I just popped into my mind.
I haven't read American Flag since I was a kid. I gotta pick that up again. Like, well, kid, like 13.
I was gonna say you were reading American Flag. Well, 8-year-old.
This kind of reminds me of, I've heard Orson Scott Card describe these type of stories as milieu stories, and you know, if that's the type of story you're telling, then world building is absolutely what you need to do. And kind of the trademark of these types of stories is someone taken from one world and put into another world. So like you guys just discussed Zeta the Space Girl, or I can think of something like Amulet or Wizard of Oz or even Lord of the Rings, because Lord of the Rings is about hobbits in their safe world being, that's very kind of very similar to our world, being introduced to this other strange world. And in that case, discovering the world is very much a part of the story. And so, I mean, world building does make sense in that case, because you're, you know, new creatures, new customs. I mean, that's part of the drama, is the fish out of water adjusting to how things are different in that world. So the details of how the world works are very important.
Right. And I think the issue is, at what point, you know, do you go too far, right? Like you're overthinking everything. And it seems like the balance is getting to the point where you have enough information that people believe it. And it's just making sure that there is, I feel like anybody who reads a story like that just wants to make sure that there is an internal logic to the whole thing, right? Like nobody wants to read a fantasy novel where it's clear that the author, you know, wasn't even consistent with their own world building rules or the way their magic system works or what have you. They just want to believe that, you know, this is all intentional and not haphazard, which, you know, I always like doing school visits in Jersey. I'm sure you've come across this, you know, doing workshops with kids and stuff. There's always two different types of kids who approach story. There's the kid who has the binders and all the world building, and they've got, you know, this generation of families related to this family, and this guy used to be a prince, but now he's a ninja, and you know, this planet exists, you know, in this crazy solar system. And then you have the other kid who's just making it all up as they go along, and they're just like, you know, what's going to happen in panel two? I don't know. I'm just going to start drawing and see what happens. which, you know, usually those stories are a lot funnier.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it's, you know, it's there's something to be said for going ahead with the story. And then if you hit a point where you realize, ooh, I need to know something, or the reader needs to know something, you can go back and figure it out then.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, and you can even, if you're worried about your page count or whatever for the day, you can put in like bit of history, you know, in parentheses. And then like after you're done with your page count for the day, you go back and go like figure out that bit of history and then add it in later. I mean, there is something to be said for that. But I think part of, you were saying, when do people know?
Yeah.
Partly it has to do, though, as what Dave's saying, what kind of writer are you?
Because that was my next question, is of those two kids, I wanted to ask Dave, which is the right kid? Which one is Goofus? Which one is Gallant? That's what I want to know.
You know, my feeling personally is, when I'm writing, I think a balance of those two things is really important. There's a time when you need to just like go with the flow and let all the crazy weird ideas come out. And then there's a time when you need to start locking it down and say, okay, let's start making this make more sense, you know? And so, yeah, I think if you can mix both those things, I think that's what's worked best for me, you know, is to try to go back and forth between those two things.
Yeah. For me, that's where I really like collaborating in the writing process. Because I think that I tend to be very stream of conscious and have a lot of different ideas that can go in a lot of different directions. And having someone to sort of bounce those ideas off of and sort of you know, sort of point me in that direction and be like, no, this is better than this, and let's sort of focus it here. Because I think for me personally, you know, nothing feels permanent right away. Like all the ideas in my head really just feel like ideas, and nothing feels permanent until I tell them to somebody else, and then they kind of sort of say, yeah, that's working or that's not working.
Yeah.
And whether that's an editor or whether that's, you know, your wife or whether that's your co-writer or the artist on the book who,
or even just an art buddy to bounce off of. Yeah. Right. So you can see what they're responding to. Right. It's like testing out material in front of an audience kind of thing, rather than just working alone, not knowing if it's any good. And then, that's the hardest part. So can we come up with a definition or some kind of distinction between the different uses of backstory here? Because I think that this is
absolutely
an opportunity. Oh, no. Son of a gun. Because, like, what we're talking about is, like, yeah, like, so can backstory refer to information within a story that supports the story but is historically back in time from where the reader's eye is in the tale, whereas maybe we could call the other version the Bible, World Bible.
And it doesn't necessarily even have to be. It could be what they don't call it this, especially in comics, because it's confusing. But a lot of writers used to do what they call character sketches,
which was
the background of the character before.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, the interesting thing, backstory is sort of everything that happens before you start your story. So, but like in the case of the groove, the one you were talking about, the llama.
Emperor's New Groove.
Oh, Emperor's New Groove. Yeah.
Sorry, I was just drawing a blank. You know,
I just call it the groove.
The groove.
The groove. Llama groove. You know, you have to argue, like, does the story actually start where the story starts, or does it start with like the earliest thing that, you know, kind of you see on screen?
Or is that the work of a hack looking for a hook? Is that what you're saying?
Maybe
sometimes you have to decide, like, hey, is this backstory just need to be where the story begins, you know?
Yeah.
Rather than using some sort of artistic convention to go back to this time in the past, maybe just need to start it in the past and then, you know, continue on from there.
But, and I hate to be that guy, but then it becomes the story, doesn't it?
That's
what
that's exactly. the weird part. Yeah, when you
it's like this circle. It's like this, you know, we get this thing that recurses on itself or whatever.
I either am ashamed or proud of doing this. I actually kind of popped around to several writing websites just to see how they describe backstory. And mostly it seemed like they were kind of indicating that it was the stuff that kind of cropped up more expositionally.
Mm.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, if somebody, you know, said, oh, I'm so sorry your dad died. But you never really, you don't flash back to it. You don't, you know, it's sort of like things that are mentioned.
So
that
might be
motivation.
It's
or
the
whatever.
David Michelinie script where Peter Parker's swinging across town going, boy, my life sure did change since I got bitten by that radioactive spider. You know?
Well, you know, that's
from the Jim Shooter days.
Yeah, but that's a certain amount of it is that, you know, a lot of people were defining it as the things that might be referred to but don't necessarily, you know, get like they're essential for knowing your character, knowing your setting, but they don't get delved into.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that, you know, because and you were talking about when does backstory become story. I mean, look at, like, talk about Tolkien. The Silmarillion was backstory.
Yeah.
But eventually it got released. Although that was after his death, so it was sort of like might have just been the estate and the publishers going, you know, this will make us money.
Something smells like money.
Sell this.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of reminds me a little bit. Maybe this is a good example. I don't know. Maybe we can poke holes in this. But it makes me think about, you know, Jaws, where I can't remember. Can I even remember it? Richard Burton? Is that his name? No, it's not Richard Burton.
Richard Dreyfuss.
No, not him. The old sailor dude.
Robert
Shaw.
Yes, Robert Shaw.
The inimitable, the awesome, the incredible. I love Robert Shaw.
Robert Shaw is amazing. But when he's telling the whole story about about being in the water with the sharks in World War II. You know, it doesn't really propel the story, you know, nor does it even tell you like, oh, he's this crusty old guy, but here's why. It's just this kind of interesting element to his character that just like sets the tone in a really cool way.
I was going to say, that's a tonal thing, isn't it? That's setting up like this feeling of dread.
It also adds to the whole, you know, it gives you a little bit about him, but it also gives you that whole, like, can you imagine being in the water knowing the sharks are there?
Or everywhere.
Fourth category. I just added it to the list for the show notes. Tonal or feeling, right?
Yeah. And it kind of adds a little bit of a sense of vulnerability to his character, too, I guess. But,
Dave, do you agree or disagree with that? For the notes?
Yeah, that sounds fine. I was just thinking it sometimes.
Yeah,
it's fine. Whatever.
Yeah. I'll allow
you
it.
You brought me here for the conflict, and I'm just so agreeable.
Yeah, there's been not one actually.
I know.
But I was thinking in some ways that it's sort of like parents. Like sometimes some characters, so like the flat you were talking about, the revelatory, like parents are like the ultimate revelatory, right? Like for most of your life, they're just your parents, right? For most of Harry Potter, Dumbledore is just, you know, the wizard, you know, father figure or whatever. Or Voldemort is just the bad guy. And then like the revelatory is like finding out that like, oh my God, our parents were like real people with lives. And like, I don't know what that has to do with anything.
And Dan's not the smartest guy in the world. And now I'm crushed. I hate life now.
Well, that's like, I think life is kind of Empire Strikes Back, right? Don't all of us kind of have that experience of, you know, Darth Vader walking up to us and telling us that he's, you know, our father, you know, finding these facts about your past that you're like, wow, I didn't realize, you know, but that's the revelatory type stuff.
Getting back to your initial story that you're working on, it sounded like are you weighing the pros and cons of having?
No, I've kind of decided what to do. With my issue, I had a character that was doing stuff that you didn't care about, and then I was going to flashback like kind of the reason that you cared, and I kind of ended up realizing that my situation was kind of like Finding Nemo, and so I just went back and wrote the beginning, said I just need to tell the beginning, and then we'll get on with the story, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think I've figured out what to do in that case. But I one other thing I did want to kind of mention though is this kind of idea too that when you do use exposition or backstory, like making that not just exposition, not just like, hey, here's some stuff we have to tell you, you know,
the info dump.
You're just kind of groaning through it. Like one thing I really love is, you know, a story that can give you that info and make it entertaining at the same time. You know, we talked about the Robert Shaw line. It's a compelling story at the same time it's doing these other things. And I was even thinking about, you know, how can we go throughout one of these without mentioning Avatar?
yeah, really.
One of my favorite kind of backstory exposition moments is when Aang and Zuko are reading about the history of the Avatar, Roku, and Fire Lord Zosin. You know, and it's this great compelling story about these two friends and how they develop and how their friendship kind of disintegrates. But at the same time, it like propels the story of Zuko and Aang at the same time. So I think it's great if you can do double duty. It's like, if you're going to tell exposition, tell about the world, do it in a way that's like, I'm interested while you're doing it, and do it in a way that's going to compel the story if you can, or propel the story as well if you can.
I was going to say also that it comes as a pacing thing too, doesn't it? I mean, because like when you talk about the Jaws scene, that was at a moment where let's slow things down a little bit. Let's make it quiet. Mm-hmm. Let's build some dread before we get to the really crazy, awesome action stuff that's going to happen in a little bit, right? So double duty, I think, is probably a good rule of thumb. You should be getting either something out of the character's motivation. You should be getting something that out of a tone, or what else? What were you going to say, Paul? You looked like you had something to say and maybe not related to what I was just saying.
I'm just listening rapidly. Oh. Actually, there was something kind of bubbling in the back, but I'll hold on to it for now.
Well, Jersey, when Brandon was mentioning Avatar, I couldn't help but think of Legend of Korra and how there's a huge sort of revelatory flashback backstory to a villain character, and how that seemed to be actually like one of the more controversial moments in that series, as far as people, I mean, the general reaction I got was that people didn't like that scene or that people thought it wasn't handled well, or wasn't, you know, or maybe it was too much information, or was at the wrong time. You know, it's like interesting to try to figure out, like, what was it about that scene that seemed to disappoint people so much?
Well, I can tell you from my standpoint what it was, is that going back to Brandon's example, here's how they're telling backstory to reveal something about the characters we're already invested in by forming what would you call parallels between them, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas the one in Korra felt like it came out of nowhere. It felt like it, if there was any parallel, if there was any kind of relation to Korra as a character, it was a little bit more obscure, and it was harder for me to find as a viewer. So, yeah, it felt like it was just like, whoa, wait, what, who's this guy, and why should I care? Yeah. You know, whereas with the original series, it's like there was a slow build with lots of flashbacks to that comet, and then the slow doling out of information over three seasons so that we really cared by then. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You also have to be very careful with that parallel. We were talking about, you know, using the parallel to reveal somebody's backstory, mm-hmm. or using backstory to parallel. There's both. You can do both. Where I just was rewatching an episode of Supernatural where, you know, it's about the two brothers doing the road trip, killing monsters. And they had this one episode where there were these two kids, and their mom ran the motel where the heroes were staying, and, you know, the older brother was looking out for the younger brother, and all that stuff. The situation, like, dredged up things about the Winchester brothers' past, mm-hmm. you know, and you got to be careful, though, because that kind of stuff, dealing with those parallels to bring out backstory, or using backstory parallels to reveal character, can get really, you know, can get really ham-handed, where it's like, yeah, I totally see that you're saying this guy is this guy and this guy is this guy. and sort of like what you're saying, and where did that come from?
Yeah.
You know, where if you're not careful with it, even a device to reveal backstory can come across as like, I see, you just threw that in there because you wanted us to go, oh,
yeah.
The older brother really loves his younger brother, and you really wanted to put that, you know, make it
sure.
strong.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, and I actually, in this case, it kind of worked for me, even though it was melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have to be really careful, because that idea of we're trying to forward the story, we're trying to add tone, we're trying to do this. But sometimes it can come off as just like, okay, why don't you just draw a big arrow at this person and go,
sure,
you know,
sure, yeah.
Love's brother. You know?
That's what makes writing so hard, right? Like, you know, it's what works for one story doesn't work for another. And, yeah. you know, you guys are talking about Lord of the Rings. And if, you know, if anybody now tried to do what those books do, people would be like, oh, God,
get on with
know,
it.
Stop talking
I don't know.
About bushes.
Have you guys read The Name of the Wind?
The Name of the Wind?
I was just going to say, have you guys read the Name of the Wind series?
Patrick Rothfuss.
No. Yeah, Patrick Rothfuss. That takes it to the nth degree. That just came to my mind. That story is all about the world, and it takes forever. It's like the most like long, drawn-out story. But at the same time, absolutely loved the story. So I don't know. That would be a good one to look as far as backstory, because that is all about slowly, slowly revealing a backstory. And it's all about world building. It's all about exploring this super, super rich, complex world.
And it's, so sometimes, you know, you see that and you're like, oh, God, that's too dense, or that's too – when I first started watching Game of Thrones, I was convinced there was no way I was going to be able to follow that series, because there's so many families and so many characters, and they're jumping back and forth. I mean, the show opens with a map of this world and hopping back and forth from place to place.
As a mechanical map.
You're like, of course, Rivendell is next to this town. Next to that. Of course, that makes total sense to me. Somehow they managed to make that work, and I don't know how I was able to make it through the two seasons, and I'm now actually intrigued and want to read the books.
I wonder
that's
how
an
much
example
it,
of you know oh. they obviously he did so much. George R. Martin did so much front loaded backstory, and but it throws you right into the story. Like he, you know, that book, or at least the show, opens up and you're just sort of like in the middle of all these characters and what is obviously years of drama, and you have to put it all together, and it does not like talk down to the audience. Like they make you, like you have to keep up or you're lost on that. I've never watched interactive special features on a DVD before Game of Thrones, as far as like, you know, like not the documentaries, but like the actual, like, you know, press forward to read about this family and read about this historic crest or whatever.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Press this to bring up name badges on each character to remind you who they are.
You know, I heard George R. R. Martin talk about Game of Thrones, and he made a comment that I wonder might reveal like how he kind of makes it work, is that he, even though it's a super complex story, he starts with everyone that you're going to follow basically in the same location. So the very beginning of the story, you kind of are introduced to everyone, with probably the exception of Daenerys. And then they all kind of spread out and do their own thing. But you kind of understand how they're connected. You at least start in kind of a more simple way.
Because the Starks and the Baratheons are all right there.
Yeah, kind of doing their feast together.
By the way, George R. R. Martin, gamer. RPG.
I wasn't slagging gaming. Yeah. I was not.
I just find
comic geek, too.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, he very much into the...
I want to get into the show. I wanted to, but the first three, I think, 2 minutes with all the disemboweled bodies and then the scary girl with the scary eyes, and I was like, ah, I had to shut it off. I couldn't take it. It's too intense.
Jersey just didn't have a large enough supply of Depends to keep it.
I'm too sensitive to that stuff, man. It was too scary. So, yeah, I'm sure it's a really well-written show, but, yeah. Ooh.
See, and most of the time I spend going, could we have another disemboweling, please?
Followed by a half-nude makeout scene, please. Can we?
Actually, if they could just make out on top of
the... Oh, God,
the...
stop. Yeah. No, that's done. Okay, well, we got to get to book recommendations because Sharon Iverson is patiently waiting in the control room to come in here to talk with us. So, you guys,
that did fly.
It did fly, I told you. Brandon and Dave, I did not ask you guys if you had any book recommendations before we did the recording. And Dave, I mean, I blindsided you with a text this morning. So if you guys wanted to do some book recommendations, you're welcome to, but we'll start with Paul, and then he's going to do musical chairs with Sharon, okay. And she's going to come in and share some of her book talks. What do you got?
I believe I've mentioned The Dreamer before. Let's see if I'm getting this in the... in the actual thing. She's wearing, you know, full dress.
That's no problem. Go ahead.
So in the past, she's, you know, fully clothed in the appropriate things. But
oh, I missed something. I think while I was out, I'm just hearing all this stuff about being fully clothed.
we're not talking about Game of Thrones.
We had a slight audio snafu for a second
Jersey was complaining about this provocative cover.
I wasn't complaining. I was just saying that it was confused I see this cover of this book called The Dreamer with a girl with a three-cornered hat and then an exposed midriff, and I was like, that doesn't look like Revolutionary War to me.
And it isn't. It's a kind of a symbolic cover. See, but it's great. Laura is a historian,
okay,
as well as a artist, and she does a great job of weaving in the history in with a pretty compelling story. And, you know, B has this whole, like, I'm dreaming this thing, and it seems more real to me in some respects than my life. It's well worth checking out. You can check it out on thedreamer.com.
Paul, if you like her stuff so much, why don't you join her podcast?
She's never invited me, that's why.
Sorry. Wait a minute, she has a podcast too? We should give a plug to that.
She does. If I could only remember the name of the podcast.
I guess I can go
to Paper Wings.
It is Paper Wings.
Oh, Paper Wings with Chris Oatley. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Lauren is in Chris Oatley. PaperWingsShow.com, if I'm not mistaken.
And I realized, actually, it's thedreamercomic.com.
Yeah.
My wife really likes the book, too. Don't go to thedreamer.com.
Oh.
Dreamercomic.com.
I'm going to go to thedreamer.com and then teenboat.com right after that. So.
Oh, yeah. And I want to just do a quick plug as
Paperwingspodcast.com is her podcast. So there we go. Okay. I was going to say, Paul, you make comics.
I do make comics.
You are not a sophist.
I'm not. Well, I'm not just a sophist. But I'm very excited because the very first comic I ever wrote, Robin of Sherwood, with uh-huh. a Y, it's about Robin Hood's daughter. Robin Hood is dead. Prince John has become king, widely regarded as one of the worst kings England ever has. And Robin and Marian's daughter has to take up the fight with a band of merry men, new and old. And this is the very first book I ever did. We've done what I call a remastered edition. It's been redrawn from some places from the original layouts and touched up and relettered. I think that Rob Davis working for Michael Larson's layouts for Partly and doing
that looks
his
very
own
pretty.
Stuff. Yeah, it came out really, really gorgeous. And that is available through IndiePlanet.com.
IndiePlanet.com.
Both digitally or print on demand.
So, yes, we will put a link to that in the show notes. And this is not the book that you did that's based on the Kevin Costner film, right?
That's because I never did one based on the Kevin Costner film. Now that you mentioned Prince of Thieves, I feel like I have to mention that Robin of Sherwood came out a couple of years before Disney did a horrible TV movie with Keira Knightley called Princess of Thieves, about Gwen, the daughter of Robin Hood.
Yeah.
I believe people will enjoy this considerably more.
Well, I bet your Robin emotes better than Costner or Knightley.
Oh, no. Don't take shots at Keira.
Oh, she's all right.
And actually, Costner's okay as long as he's not doing...
I will not rest until my father's name has been avenged.
Exactly.
Yes, I swear with these drops of my own blood.
That's what I'm saying, though. As long as he's not doing... I mean, great in Bull Durham. But,
Desperado, he was awesome, but...
Desperado?
Was it
Desperado?
No, not Desperado. Like
Silverado?
Silverado. Silverado. I loved him in Silverado.
I did not like Prince of Thieves. I did not like it on the house. I did not like it with a mouse.
The Sheriff of Nottingham was great in Prince of Thieves.
He
stole the movie.
He was in a different movie. Alan Rickman was in a different movie. But
How's
anyway...
Christian Slater was in that.
Dreamboat.
Yes. Right. He's hot.
Dude, we had the same father.
Yeah.
But I hate you, dude.
This is shooting fish in a barrel.
We
guys.
Really need to let Sharon get in here.
We need to let Sharon get in here. But so, Robin of Sherwood, people should go to indieplanet.com and find it today. It will be linked in the show notes at comicsacreat.com.
And you can actually go to robinofsherwood.com.
Oh, you can just do that if you're just listening in your car.
There are links there.
Pull over and read it on your iPad.
There you go.
So,
well, you can go to robinofsherwood.com for links.
Oh.
I do not have it serialized on the web as yet.
No, I'm saying to get the PDF.
Yes.
To read on your digital device.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So, Paul Story, thank you so much for coming back.
It was
back.
Really great to be back. Guys, so good to see you.
Great to see you, Paul.
Yeah, good to see you, Paul.
Thanks for all the wonderful food for thought on storytelling.
And backstory.
And
you'll have to have me back.
Yeah, I'd love to have Story back for some more backstory. There we go. We fit it in.
Oh, there we go.
All right. Thanks, Paul. So we're going to do the switcheroo, get Sharon in here. And I will turn to Brandon Dayton. Did you have anything that you wanted to do a shout-out for today?
Yeah, I've got two recommendations. One is one that Jersey recommended I read last week, The Three Shadows.
Oh, my gosh.
It's one that's been out for a while, but just a fantastic piece of art.
Cyril Pedrosa.
So art's great, storytelling's great. There's some things about backstory in there too that are interesting. But I really like that. The other one I just picked up was Hilda and the Night Giant, I believe.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah,
which is, I guess, was a big hit at SPX. But the printing on it is just beautiful. Like, that's like holding it in my hands. I didn't want my hands to ruin the book. So it's kind of a fun one to pick up just to kind of, I guess, No Brow Press printed it, and they're known for having really cool, well thought out printed stuff. And
you should just put that on the iPad, though.
But yeah, that's one that's a good argument for why books should stay books and not go digital. It's just a really beautifully printed book.
You mean in addition to digital?
In addition, sure.
Well, no, but Hilda and the Night Giant is a book that works better as a book than digital. There's no question. I mean, the printing on that thing is, and it's printed really large too, which
big format.
Yeah. It's no, there are some out there that work better in paper form. So, Those are both good picks, Brandon. Dave, did you have anything?
I just wanted to give another shout out to a book that you guys mentioned last week with Gina on the episode, Broxo by Zach Giolongo. Definitely sort of about pretty much everything we were talking about. It's sort of a barbarian story, but it's about a girl who's searching this mountain for this clan that seems to have been wiped out. So it's sort of like a mystery story of finding, like, you know, what happened to these people. So lots of world building, but stuff that, you know, there's obviously a lot more world building than you actually see in the book. But it's sort of a great fantasy story that goes down pretty easy. It has a lot of great action, and I think the visual storytelling is definitely the strongest thing about the book. It's just beautiful to sort of like see, you know, the panel to panel moments are just great. It's really worth checking out.
So Broxo from First Second Books. I'll see if I get Zach to come on the show to talk about his books.
Oh, I'm sure he would.
Yeah, because I've heard nothing but good things, and I will read it. I'm sure it's already in the library's collection, or will be soon. It'll be added to the collection shortly. So with that, I have to turn to Sharon Iverson. Oh, my gosh, Sharon. So we had Paul's story back after all these
yeah.
months, and we get Sharon Iverson back after all this time. So
it has
you.
Been a while.
It has. You've been a busy lady. So.
Yeah, no, you're the busy guy.
Well, but you're the busy lady who's putting out all these comics programs at the Ann Arbor District Library.
Yes.
We had that great one with Tony Cliff.
Yeah.
What was it, 2 weeks ago?
Yep.
Something like that. And yep. and that reminds me, before I forget, Tony Cliff actually sent me a link in regards to today's episode, and it was to a Wikipedia article, which I'll put in the chat. The Art of Dramatic Writing by Lajos Igri? Oh, no. I hate being that guy who mispronounces names. But have you guys heard of this? Originally published by Simon & Schuster in 1942, How to Write a Play. Igri's treatise was revised and published as The Art of Dramatic Writing in 1946. I will put a link in the show notes for that, and it's posting into the chat now. So there's another resource to follow up on in regards to this whole backstory stuff. So, okay, Sharon, what
yeah.
do you got?
What do I have?
What do you got?
I had to do some homework while I was on the public information desk today.
I kind of emailed you this morning and said, "Oh, this is what we're talking about today. You might want to get some books that actually refer to this topic." So
yeah, and I'm glad Brandon mentioned Hilda and the Midnight Giant, because I think one episode back or two, I was paging. I just love that book too. So
yeah,
that's
it's
awesome.
A great one.
So I had these books and I thought, okay, what's the backstory here? I don't know if this is showing up. Binky and the Space Cat.
Binky the Space Cat. We've talked about this one on the Kids Comics Revolution, right, Dave?
Yeah.
And so it's a series too.
Yep, it's a series. I'm just going to mention in the first book, Binky gets his little package in the mail. He's going to be an official space cat, and that means he can fight aliens. And what you don't know until you go back to when Binky was just a little kitten. The whole story of how, you know, he noticed all these buzzy things flying around, and that he defined those as the aliens, and therefore he was on a mission to take care of ridding the world as we know it of all flying objects, which when he tried and failed miserably to fly himself, then he decided, we'll just do away with all the rest. So that's one fun book. City of Spies was kind of interesting.
This one we talked about before, but it can't get recommended enough.
No,
Dave, you
yeah.
recommended this one before, right?
Yeah,
I love that book.
Yeah, and I've talked about it too. But, you know, I was kind of just thinking of the backstory thing, the fact that Ella is doing comics, and the comics that are presented, you know, kind of are the old style dotted format. So that
yeah,
when
the Benday dots is
yeah.
what they call them.
Benday,
which is referring to a guy, isn't it, Brandon? Benday, who came up with that mechanical toning process, I think. No?
I just know the name. That's it. Ben like
cool.
the Lichtenstein style dots.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to be confused with Bengay.
No. It has nothing to do with that.
So I mean, it's part of, you know, it's kind of a side story bit. I mean, it's part of the story, but at the same time, it's revealing more about, you know, contrasting her real life, her lonely life, with the character that she would like to be, you know, more robust, more of a heroine kind of thing. So that's kind of cool. I guess you call that a side story? I don't know. whatever. I listened to your discussion, and it's like, yeah, what the heck is a backstory anyway? And then there's Anne Frank, the biography that was done by Sid Jacobson and Ernie Colon, and the little snapshot bits, because the time period and the breadth of the history and the action that's going on, those little snapshots give you, you know, little snippets of the history as the story's going along. So,
And I made no secret of my admiration for Ernie Colon. That guy is amazing. I'll read anything that guy draws hungrily. So,
yeah. And my last one is Ernest and Rebecca, My Best Friend is a Germ by Guillaume Bianco. And it's about another lonely little girl whose parents are maybe going to be divorced. You don't know. I think this is a multi-volume series, too. And what's interesting is that she's telling you the story about how she catches this germ, or it catches her, but it anyway. And, you know, so it's a first-person depiction, but every so often, as in the six panels here, it goes to a cartoony, like she's literally drawing.
This is
the
her
little
mind's eye.
Sidebar, and so she's reflecting back on an event that where they drove somewhere last Sunday, but it's all this little mini cartoony, and then it goes forward again.
And then, that's one of the things that comics does really well, is that we can very easily and visually show you that this is a flashback. This is inside the kid's mind, right? Mm-hmm. But just by changing the art style or changing the panel border and stuff. A little harder to do that in film. Animation can do it, obviously, because it's using cartoons. But, but yeah, that's awesome. And this has a really lovely animated look to it. Have you guys heard of this, Brandon or Dave?
Mm-mm.
I mean, talk about an interesting storyline.
Ernest
and Rebecca. Is the germ.
It's from Paper Cuts. I had not heard of this before. This looks really pretty.
Yeah, I think it's brought over from Europe. But I'm not sure.
They have all the good comics over there.
I know.
All right, I've got one.
Okay.
This one is I brought it to loan it to you.
Ooh.
And this is the original 1998 edition of Quick and Forbidden by Dave Roman. And Dave, I honestly didn't know you were going to be here today. I honestly goodness did not know you were going to be here today. But I brought it because I knew Sharon would want to read it. This was the self-published edition by Dave and John Green back in the 90s.
Wow.
So this is Deep Cuts, old school Jax Epoch, Quick and Forbidden. And it's really good. I mean, I wasn't doing stuff that good in 1998, so it kind of broke my heart in a way.
Neat.
But So I found it at the Dawn Treader of all places.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was just walking around downtown. I was like, I'll stop in the Dawn Treader to see what they got. And I walked by their comic section. There was the spine. I was like, duh! So I grabbed
it. Oh, it looks so nice.
It's still in good shape.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody ever read it, did they, Dave?
Probably not.
No, it's got some love showing on it.
Yes.
It's a little dinged up in places, but yeah, I don't know if this is still around anywhere. If anybody can find it, if you look on
not
eBay.
That version of it. You can still get the what I consider the officially printed version from AIT Planet Lar.
Oh,
yeah, I think it's still available through Amazon or you know certainly on used bookstore sites and stuff. But no, I think it's still technically in print.
Oh,
from AIT Planet Lar. Yeah, but there's two volumes of. Now is that one called Quick and Forbidden, or is it?
It's just called Quick and Forbidden.
Oh, it's just called Quick and Forbidden. Yeah, that's why it's old school. So the newer version is called Jax Epoch and the Quick and Forbidden.
Oh,
you can just call it Jax Epoch. I'm fine with just that.
But this one also has pinups by Klaus Janson and an afterword by Klaus Janson, and there's a lot of great pinups in here actually.
Did Scott Morse do that? Oh no, is that who did the or did Mark Crilly do? I forget. Somebody did something in that too.
There's a whole mess of really great. I miss pinups, man. There's a Dave Roman pinup, a John Green pinup, and then we've got a bunch of John Green ones. C.S. Morse. And
Scott Morse, back when he was C.S. Morse.
Oh, yeah. So I can hold that up so people can see. So
And actually the revised version, like the full printed one, has like more pinups and like full color pinups in the back, too.
Oh, fancy. There's the Klaus Janson one. Oh, man. Looks sweet.
So this is the Jax Epoch story, right?
Yeah, it is. So the main character's name is Jax, and when we originally named the series Quick and Forbidden, it was like one of those things that we quickly regretted.
quickly.
This is a discussion for another time when we talk about titling books, right?
Yeah, that's definitely.
But it was of its time because it felt like a lot of other stuff that was being produced in the 90s in terms of title and tone, right? Quick and Forbidden sounds like the kind of mysterious, like, oh, what's this new world that I have to get invested in, right? The kind of title.
See, that's great that you thought that because that's exactly what we thought it was. But immediately people were like, so what does this have to do with the accounting software exactly?
Oh, no.
We were like... And then the irony is then I get a job at Staples where I like work right in front of like a whole shelf of Quicken software.
And it just stares you down.
Oh, you're haunting me. You're haunting me.
Oh, man. Well, it's a good book either way if you got the original old school edition or if you got the new. And that's in the library's collection,
yes,
too. You've done a book talk on that one before. Yep. So, okay. Well, any closing thoughts on this whole backstory stuff, guys? Now that Paul's not there. Oh, Paul is.
No, Paul's got a mic now.
Let's create Paul's backstory right now.
So I wanted to give everybody a chance for any final thoughts, words on this before we close the show. Sharon, did you have any promotion things that you wanted to?
Oh, well, we want to talk about what's coming up in November, November 4, Sunday, 1 to 3, right here at the Downtown Library from in the fourth floor meeting room. We have Michelangelo Cicerone that's going to talk about the whole world and fun of comics jams.
Comics jams. And we're going to do a comics jam.
And we're going to do it. So there's another chance for backstory stuff.
Collaborative story writing.
Yeah.
Right. So that's in the, is that on the fourth floor?
Yep.
Fourth floor conference meeting. Room mm-hmm. or meeting room at the Ann Arbor District Library downtown branch, Sunday,
November 4th,
1 to 3 p.m.
1 to 3.
Yeah, comics.adl.org if you want to look it up, folks, anybody in the local area. Anything else? December, we've got another one. But
yes,
Casey
Van Heist.
Casey Van Heist of wintersandlavelle.com is going to be our guest
speaker. Manga storytelling.
We're going to talk about the mangas.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. No final thoughts on backstory? We're good? We feel like we walked around that one a little bit?
I feel like we got nowhere close to defining this at
all. You know, that's the thing. That's what we're supposed to do. We're just supposed to do a quick little walk around the idea, see what it's shaped like, feel its different parts from our various vantage points, and then go, well, it's kind of like that, and now we'll put it to the listeners. They can email us.
I was going to say, get viewer feedback, and then we can maybe do a follow-up.
Yeah, we could always do a part two to this one, and if you have any...
maybe front story.
Yeah, we'll do front story.
Or side.
It's going to be all about my book, which is my Quick and Forbidden, that was named poorly and nobody knows what the heck it's about. The front. What's it about? Read the book.
Hot front, cold front, we don't know.
Yeah, I don't even know. So you can email us at comicsaregreat@gmail.com and I will forward it on to all parties involved and we can always resume for a part two to this one if you guys are interested. And with that, I will say, Paul, thank you. Paul Story of Storyville.com. Thank you for being part of this one. Anything you already promoted Robin, so okay, you're done. Brandon Dayton. Brandon Dayton, BrandonDayton.com. What do you got that's coming up? You've been working hard on
just my website. I mean, I'm just constantly posting stuff there right now. So, you know, nothing else big to promote right now.
But you've got the blog and you've got the Twitter presence, Brandon Dayton on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So people can always message you that way if they want to.
Absolutely.
Want clarification on your points made. All right. When the new book is done, we'll have you back to talk about that too.
Sure.
And then last but not least, Dave Roman of yaytime.com. Thanks for rolling out of bed to be a part of this one.
No problem.
The glamorous life of the artist.
Going back to bed as soon as this is over, Dave?
Yeah, probably. Take a nap after this one.
Yes, that time.
So what do you got? What do you got that you want to point people at?
I've got Teen Boat still available. I've got Astronaut Academy 2 coming out in May of next year. But I think stores will probably be able to start pre-ordering it in a month or so. I don't know how that works. And I think I have another book. I contributed to an anthology called Dear Teen Me that comes out like next week or something like that.
And is that what the title suggests? It's like letters to yourself?
It's letters to your teenage self. And mine is a comic where like a lot of the book is prose, but there's a couple of comics in there. I think Faith Erin Hicks did one. And Tom Engelberger, who is the author of The Strange Case of Origami Yoda, which is an extremely, extremely popular and funny series of middle grade books.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So that's Letters to Teenage Me?
It's called Dear Teen Me.
Dear Teen Me. Okay. So we'll see. Yeah. Okay. So we'll
it
put
is
that...
probably the most embarrassing comic I've ever done. So.
Oh, now I gotta
sure
read
pick it.
It
up.
Yeah, because it's totally like memoir, autobio, like stuff that I probably should not have written about that now I regret and it's too late.
Oh, man.
We all want to read.
I
that,
know.
Dave.
He just sold some books.
Yeah, that's right.
Better way to hook everybody.
Yeah, really. Okay, well, cool. Well, and then Sharon Iverson of comics.aadl.org, mm-hmm. Thank you for being here.
Sure.
With great book recommendations. Always good to see you. And until next time, everybody, this show will be archived at comicsaregreat.com/CAG66. And again, you can find it on, we stream live every other Wednesday at comicsaregreat.tv and at youtube.com/comicsaregreat. Thank you once again to Matt Dubay of the Ann Arbor District Library for being the technical director on the show and always accepting the challenge of putting on a difficult show.
Oh, it's always fun.
And check out aadl.org for more of these the various podcasts that they produce out of here. Until next time, everybody, I have been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on the Twitters. Okay, bye.